Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Queen's University's contributions to Canadian Blood Services' new fall get-together campaign.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs Today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca.
Queen's University has officially joined the Canadian Blood Services' first-ever Fall Get-Together campaign, a nationwide challenge uniting 106 colleges and universities to help Canada reach a major milestone, 1 million active blood and plasma donors in the next 5 years. Canadian Blood Services is a vital lifeline for many Canadians, supporting blood, plasma, stem cell, organ, and tissue donations across the country. Between now and December 31st, students are encouraged to give together by booking group donation appointments at local donor centers. Each campus competes for the highest donor point average, with top schools earning limited edition hoodies and a Friendsgiving banquet. Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services sat down with CFRC to share more about this new initiative and the Queen's Campus Challenge.
This fall, we're launching the Fall Get Together, which is a national donor challenge that celebrates the power of giving together. We're speaking directly to groups, friends, families, colleagues, classmates, teammates, programs, and inviting them to book and donate together. The Campus Challenge works that at all post-secondary school environments across Canada, we're encouraging campuses to set up a team if they're not already registered in the Partners for Life program, and then to add members to that team and make a group donation together. So points are accumulated through your membership numbers and the group donations that the campus does together. Across the board, all across Canada, we're seeing many schools get involved and many new schools get involved. So that's important. That's the whole purpose of the campaign, is to engage people to get involved with the campus and donate blood so they can assist and support patients all across Canada who need blood and blood products to maintain and live a healthy lifestyle.
While this challenge is a first for post-secondary schools across Canada, Barfoot says Queen's is no stranger to supporting the cause, with a long-standing history of student donors and blood drives on campus.
So Queen's University has been involved in our Partners for Life program since inception. Queen's set up a national partnership team over 25 years ago, and it was developed and started by some nursing students at Queen's. Throughout the years, we have a very active club on campus called Queen's University Blood Team, which is QUBT for short. They raised awareness about the need for people to join the stem cell registry and to donate blood. They organize group donations. We have on-campus blood drives that they support and volunteer at. For this campaign, the campaign results only display nationally the top 10. And at this point, Queen's is not on the top 10, so I'm putting the challenge out there.
As Barfoot mentioned, there's still work to be done, both at Queen's and across the country, to reach CBS's goal of 1 million new donors in the next 5 years.
Obviously, as the population increases, so does the need for blood and blood products. With that comes a need for blood donors to support to ensure that the demand is met. The demand is met through hospital patients, people that require surgeries, we need to increase our national donor base to 1 million over the next 5 years. People might fall out of the blood system for numerous reasons. So we always need to replenish, and this is especially important for the younger. So minimum age is 17 to donate blood. So we encourage our youth to get out and learn more about donating blood, check their eligibility, and then join the this challenge and the national campaign, as well as the Queen's University blood team.
And she adds, joining as a team is one of the best ways to make an impact.
More than a third of Canadians under the age of 35 who have donated blood before have done so as part of a group. So it's a great way for a group to get together and give together. Also, it can be less intimidating if you're a first-time blood donor to go with a group of friends, fellow students, or colleagues, so you can donate together and go through the experience first time as a team. It's a cool way to get together and understand that you are really giving back to fellow Canadians.
Queen students can take part in the Fall Get Together campaign by booking group donations or taking part in the next on-campus event on Monday, November 17th, running from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the BioSci atrium.
I would encourage every student to first go online to blood.ca, take the eligibility quiz, make sure that you are eligible to donate. We have a fantastic website that goes through the parameters, the criteria, and explains the need for blood and blood products. Once they determine if they are eligible, to reach out to the Queen's University blood team, join one of their upcoming group donations because they have many in the books, and we have on-campus blood drives happening at Queen's in November. So if they join the National Fall Campaign Campus Challenge, and then join the Queen's University blood team and book an appointment, their donation will be counted towards this challenge.
Once again, that was Debbie Barfoot with Canadian Blood Services on this year's first ever Fall Get Together campaign. To learn more and book a group donation, you can head to blood.ca. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for The Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forestell, about Conservative MPP Rick Breese's impassioned speech to the Ontario Legislature about gender-based domestic violence.
Thank you, Jesse. The Ontario government took steps to address gender-based violence last week, but stopped short of declaring it an epidemic, and one regional politician took a stand on the matter. The government announced new shelter and survivor support funding on Monday, November 3rd, and supported language recognizing gender-based violence as endemic, meaning long-standing, pervasive, and systemic. The government did not support declaring it an epidemic, which would have carried additional policy and funding expectations. On November 3rd, the government announced more than $26.7 million in new funding to protect survivors of gender-based violence. The funding will expand access to emergency shelters, including rural and Indigenous-led facilities, and support programs such as the Family Court Support Worker Program. On Wednesday, November 5th, two key motions were presented to the legislative chamber. Charmaine A. Williams, Progressive Conservative MPP for Brampton Centre and Associate Minister of Women's Social and Economic Opportunity, sought unanimous consent for a motion recognizing intimate partner violence as endemic. The motion passed unanimously, affirming that the problem is longstanding and systemic. Later that day, Lisa Gretzky of the NDP Windsor West proposed a motion to declare intimate partner violence as epidemic, reflecting the language used by the 2022 Renfrew County inquest into the 2015 triple femicide of Carol Colton, Anastasia Kuchik, and Natalie Warmerdam. The jury produced 86 recommendations for system changes that the province and other public bodies could implement. Since then, more than 50 municipalities have followed that inquest's recommendation. Gretzky's motion did not pass, as a single Progressive Conservative member opposed it. On Thursday, November 6th, Hastings, Lennox, and Addington MPP Rick Brzee picked up on the debate, emphasizing that the endemic designation enabling the Standing Committee on Justice Policy to conduct a thorough review and transition from testimony to tangible action. Brzee highlighted findings from the Standing Committee's review that heard from over 150 individuals, including 60 survivors and 90 expert witnesses, pointing to the pervasive nature of gender-based violence and the need for systemic interventions. Brzee's speech underscores the personal and societal stakes addressing gender-based violence require sustained commitment, accountability, and the courage to confront both history and everyday realities, ensuring that survivor voices lead to tangible systemic change. Debate on the motion will continue in future sittings of the Ontario Legislature. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forstel for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about the appointment of a new ward councillor in the township of Leeds in the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Dinah. Lansdowne resident Krista LeClaire has been appointed as the new Ward 3 councillor for the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands following a unanimous vote at last Monday night's council meeting. LeClaire fills the seat left vacant by Brock Gorell, who resigned on September 30th. She was one of four candidates considered for the position, along with Thomas Hopkins, Jason Page, and former councillor John Paul Jackson. LeClaire studied community economic development and strategic leadership, focusing her studies on municipal politics and diversifying local councils. She said she looks forward to connecting with residents and helping to bridge the gap between community members and local government. LeClaire has experience serving on several local, regional, provincial, and federal boards, including RTO 9 and the Kingston Chamber of Commerce, and as Executive Director of Kingston Accommodation Partners. Her appointment marks the second council vacancy filled this year. In March, Monique Antoine Hartley was appointed as Ward 2 councillor following Mark Jameson's resignation in December of 2024. LeClaire joins Mayor Karina Smith-Gatke, Councillor Angela Kelman, and Councillor Antoine Hartley as the fourth woman currently serving on TLTI Council.
Thank you, Jesse. Now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM, Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about the possible creation of a new solar farm in Loyalist Township.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Loyalist Township Council heard from Carbon Free Technology, an Ontario-based company looking to build a new solar project in Mill Haven. The company presented plans to council, noting the project would include a community benefits agreement. It would also look to increase local tax revenue and contribute to the province's grid reliability. The project looks to use up to 20 acres of fenced-in land that is over 1 kilometer away from residences. Before moving forward, the company is looking to engage with the public and local groups. VP and legal for the company, Emma Coyle, explained the company's next steps going forward.
We've begun neighborhood canvassing. We have a public meeting on November 24th. The First Nation partnership, we do have the support of the Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte. We don't yet have the official resolution from them, but we fully expect for that to be finalized. On November 26th, there will be a staff report to council with respect to the project. And on December 9th, we'll be coming back with a request for a municipal support resolution with respect to this project.
VP in Engineering and Special Projects for the company, Maggid Sami, noted the different approaches they're taking in community engagement.
Through the website, we've already received a comment or a query, and we've engaged with that party already, and have had a few phone calls, and we've been trying to arrange a longer discussion as well. So it might take a few different approaches.
Carbon Free Technology has projects worldwide and has worked on projects locally as well. In 2015, the company was a development partner to Samsung for Kingston Solar.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a safe ride holiday program launching in Northumberland County.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Thinking of partying this holiday season but want to do so responsibly and avoid DUI checkpoints and breathalyzers? Call the YMCA Northumberland on weekends in late November and December, as their volunteers will drive you and your vehicle home safely. Users of this service are encouraged to donate to the YMCA. Director of Marketing and Philanthropy, Catherine Harrison, and Coordinator of People and Community Engagement, Sam Kelly, speak to me about the importance of this program.
Operation Red Nose is a service that YMCA Northumberland has been running for the last 10 years. It's our 10-year anniversary, where we are driving people home safe for the holidays. And it's not just driving the person home, we drive the person and their car home. So it's a service to keep the road safe and everybody can have fun doing it.
So then tell me, how do I, if I want to use that service, how do I go about doing that?
Sure. For using the service, we have a phone number that you call the night of. We're operating for 6 nights during the holiday season. And during those nights, which are November 29th, December 6th, December 13th, December 19th, December 20th, and December 31st, New Year's Eve, you call our Operation Red Nose hotline phone number.
So then you were discussing that the volunteers drive you home and your vehicle home. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's what makes this service special and different than a taxi service. So we actually have drive teams of 3 people that come to where you are, and 2 of the people come and take you and your vehicle and any of your passengers and drive that vehicle and you and your passengers back to home. And then we have the 3rd person in an escort car that follows that the car, and then the escort car takes all the volunteers and takes them to the next person for driving home.
So you said you've been doing this, the YMCA has been doing this 10 years. Now that's,
yes,
that's a long time. So congratulations. I think that's a great, great initiative. It's a lot of miles though.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually did a count of the number of kilometers that Operation Red Nose has been operating in the last 10 years, over 50,000 kilometers. And to put that in perspective, that is going across Canada 7 times.
Okay, Sam, so 5,000 kilometers on average a year, just in Northumberland County over 6 days. That mm-hmm. that is quite an accomplishment. How do you coordinate that?
Well, we first of all call on our volunteers. So we have some volunteers who have been with us since the very beginning, the full 10 years. And we're always looking for new volunteers because each drive team consists of 3 people. As Catherine had mentioned, we have 2 individuals that take the caller and the caller's car home, and then the escort driver follows. Ideally, we like to have about 5 teams of 3. So 15 volunteers is ideal for an evening, as well as 2, at least 2 at headquarters that are fielding the calls and dispatching. So we heavily rely on volunteers to keep this service running and running smoothly.
So if I want to volunteer mm-hmm. to help with the program, mm-hmm. what's the process that I have to do to get in the program?
Well, the first thing you can do is go to our website. And if you click on the community tab in the drop-down menu, there will be the option to visit our Operation Red Nose page. And there is a form to fill out on our website. And it just requires some information related to what nights you're available, what role you would like to take on, and just some information related to sort of your driver's license, making sure you have a valid driver's license. And then we do require anyone that's coming in new who doesn't already have a current police check to fill out the appropriate paperwork to get a police check. And that's what's required to be a volunteer.
So you're looking for 17 volunteers approximately.
Ideally.
Ideally. Have they struggled to get that number?
We've been pretty lucky. I came on as coordinator last year. So last year would have been my first year coordinating the volunteer piece. And we were pretty well established each night with the appropriate number of volunteers. New Year's Eve was a bit more of a challenge, but we had a lot of people coming through at the last minute, available and giving up their New Year's Eve to come out and volunteer with us. So we ended up with a full team on New Year's, but it was kind of down to the wire.
So on the day of when I sign up and mm-hmm. I want to drive mm-hmm. or I'm participate, what can I expect the day of?
You would arrive to headquarters around, I believe it's around 8 or 8:30 p.m. We typically open up our phone lines at 9. And sometimes we're, you know, waiting around for that first caller. We're playing games. We often have local restaurants that are donating snacks and food for our volunteer team. We're loading up on coffee, having some laughs, socializing a little bit, waiting for those calls to come in. And then when the call comes in, the teams are dispatched to that particular location, and then things just kind of move along after that.
So, Catherine, if I want to set up a ride well ahead of the event I'm going to, can I do that? And if not, why can't I?
No, the service is structured so that it's managing calls as in real time. It's just the way that the Operation Red Nose system works, that it's based on calls rather than prearranged calls. That's the way we've been operating for 10 years. So we just enable us to run it in a way that is based on need at the time.
I understand this is kind of a free service, but people may want to donate because that's kind of the fair thing to do. Other people are giving up their time and resources to make sure I get a safe ride home. How do I go about donating money or whatever to the cause?
Sure, thanks. You're right. This service is not only a community service to help our roads be safer, but it's also an opportunity for us to raise money for our Strong Communities campaign. And we do that through sponsorships. We have local businesses that are sponsoring and promoting and supporting our program, which we're really thankful for. And yes, riders are asked to donate as a thanks to the service, and then that donation goes to support our Strong Communities campaign. Our Strong Communities campaign is a campaign designed to give access to everyone, all the families, all children, all seniors in our community, regardless of means. They get access to YMCA programming and services. So yeah, you can donate. And the way you can donate is during rides, we have point of sale systems. We take cash. After the fact, some people do e-transfers if they don't have money on them. We have all different ways that you can pay. And we also have donation on our website.
Reporting for CFWN and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jesse Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Thursday, November 20th, daytime high of 5 degrees, cloudy conditions here in the city of Kingston, only dropping down 2 degrees to 3 overnight. Friday, November 21st, warmest day of the week, high of 9 degrees, but there is a 90% chance of precipitation, which will cool things back down, as Saturday, November 22nd, we will get a daytime high of 4 with partly sunny conditions, dropping down to just a shade below freezing overnight. Sunday, November 23rd, daytime high of 5, low of 0. And then the start of next week, Monday, November 24th, a 5-degree day with a mix of sun and cloud. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. As a reminder, we have the nighttime Santa Claus Parade and Tree Lighting Ceremony this Saturday, November 22nd, and there are some relevant road closures related to that. Market Street, Ontario to King, will be closed from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m. King Street, Brock to Clarence, will be closed from 5:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. And Princess Street, Sir John A. Macdonald to Ontario, will be closed from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Here are some non-holiday-related road closures. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert, Princess to Mac, is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne, is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl, Collingwood to Toronto, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. King Street, Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes, is closed November 19th from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. for the Kingston Frontenacs school day game. King Street, Tragically Hip Way to Place d'Armes, is closed November 19th at 8 p.m. to November 21st at 8 a.m. for Blue Rodeo-related event, parking and storage at Slush Puppy Place. Kings Court Avenue, concession to First, is closed until November 21st for gas main installation. Sydenham Road, Princess to Catarocway Woods, is closed November 17th and 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day to facilitate the safe operation of a crane lift. Raglan Road, Division to Main, is closed until November 30th from 7:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. each day for gas main installation. Toronto Street, Durham to Park, is closed November 3rd to November 28th for installation of new water main, sanitary, and storm services. And Victoria Street, Union to Johnson, is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.